We don't like to admit it to ourselves, still less to outsiders, but every year that passes, a few more churches in this country die. Churches that once had packed congregations bustling with vitality. Churches that bear the names of great and godly pastors on their walls, perhaps. Churches that were once the scene of remarkable revivals. Yet today they stand some like empty barns, the doors kept open on Sundays by a handful of 80-year-olds, some turned into factories and warehouses, some transformed into temples or mosques for the use of new immigrant communities. Inscribed over the doors of these derelict sanctuaries, you often see those quaint Old Testament names they used to love to give them in the optimism of their infancy. Ebenezer, the Stone of Help, Rehoboth, Broad Places, Bethesda, the House of Mercy, Providence, Grace, Hope, and of course Zion. But a more appropriate name for their old age would, I'm afraid, very often have been that which the wife of Phinehas gave to her child when she heard that the Ark of the Covenant had been captured by the Philistines. Ichabod. The glory has departed. Now, why do churches die? Why sometimes, indeed, in some parts of the world, like North Africa and Asia, have entire Christian civilizations been lost to other ideologies and religions? Well, this evening we're going to examine just one reason. I don't say it's the only reason. There are undoubtedly many factors involved in the decline of churches, not the least of which is the inscrutable mystery of God's purposes. It would be grossly naive and not a little arrogant to think that we could rationalize all the vicissitudes of church history in one sermon. Yet there can be no doubt that within the complex web of God's dealings with his people, one reason for the departure of God's blessing is judgment. As Christ warned the church at Ephesus, "You've forsaken your first love," he said. "Remember the height from which you've fallen. Repent and do the things you did at first. If you don't, I will come and remove your lampstand from its place." For God is not irrevocably committed to any local shrine. He's not a God of places. He's a God of people. And when those people fail persistently and unrepentantly, then no matter how ancient their traditions, no matter how sacred their church buildings, no matter how blessed their past history may have been, the glory will depart. That's the lesson we learned from our study passage in Ezekiel this evening. We're going to break it up into three sections. The first I call the glory of God offended. That's in chapter 8. The second, the glory of God avenged, chapter 9, and then thirdly, the glory of God relocated, chapters 10 and 11. Let's look first at the glory of God offended in that chapter 8 which we read. "In the sixth year, in the sixth month, I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me." Ezekiel, you remember, is with the Jewish exiles in Babylonia. The year is now 591 BC. And things back in Jerusalem are really beginning to hot up a bit. Zedekiah, the puppet king placed there by Emperor Nebuchadnezzar, is under increasing pressure from the populace to rebel against his imperial master and make a bid to restore Judah's national pride. The exiles in Babylonia are worried. Disturbing reports are reaching them. What's going to happen? How would it affect them? News travels so frustratingly slowly across those 500 miles of desert. It's out of date before it arrives. If only we could know what was going on. Oh, wait a minute, maybe we can. What about paying Ezekiel a call? Oh, I know he's a bit eccentric, but he comes from a good family, you know. And he does have a most uncanny gift of telepathy. Maybe he can get attuned in on Jerusalem and provide us with some up-to-date information of what's going on there. So we find this delegation of senior men from the exilic community sitting in front of the prophet, wondering, perhaps with a mixture of foreboding and skepticism whether he was going to have one of his odd turns or not. And they're not left in doubt for very long. The hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. I looked and I saw a figure like that of a man. Waist down he was like fire. From there up he was as bright as glowing metal. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and took me in visions of God to Jerusalem. We mustn't allow the vividness and detail of the commentary that follows to make us forget those last words, in visions of God to Jerusalem. It doesn't seem to me that this is, as some have supposed, an example of psychic levitation, still less of Star Trek-like conveyance by energy beam. Ezekiel's bodily presence remained firmly planted in Babylonia. It was only his prophetic imagination that was transported in a vision, though not without, it seems, some rather uncomfortable physical sensation of high-speed travel accompanying the experience. He took me by the hairs of my head. Still, what he sees on arrival is far more hair-raising than the manner of his journey was. He put me down at the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, as in the vision I had seen in the plain. Then he said to me, Son of man, look towards the north. So I looked, and in the entrance north of the gate, I saw this idol. Ezekiel, of course, already knew that it was the issue of idolatry that would prove decisive in Judah's condemnation. Because as we saw last week, 14 months before, in his initial set of visions, this phrase, detestable idols, had been burnt into his mind by constant repetition. But not even he, I suspect, prior to this experience, had realized the extent to which idolatry had reclaimed its grip on Jerusalem itself. Immediately he arrives, he's confronted by ominous evidence of it. The idol that provokes to jealousy. Scholars tell us that judging from the rather unusual word for idol that Ezekiel uses here, this was probably a replica of the carved wooden Asherah, which King Manasseh had erected some 50 years before in Jerusalem. You can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 21, those of you who are Bible students. It was a crude fertility symbol. Such things were not new in Israel. The prophets had been complaining about them and the ritual prostitution that went with them for centuries. Indeed, Asherah are mentioned as early as the book of Judges. But usually one associated them with the rural peasantry. Here, however, one such obelisk of obscenity has been set up not just within the capital city at the center of the cultus, but actually within the temple precincts. In full view of everyone who came to worship, including the king, who would regularly have used this north gate since it was the obvious one to go from the palace to the temple by. Ezekiel's observation post is so arranged as to impress the resulting spiritual confrontation upon him with the intensity. See, he stands on the inside of the north gate. Looking north through the gate, he sees the idol. But looking south from the gate, the direction he faces when he is set down, he sees hovering over the inner sanctuary the Shekinah glory that symbolized God's presence. No wonder the Spirit calls it an idol of jealousy. Jehovah was the husband of Israel, and bound to her by solemn covenant. He demanded her exclusive devotion, he said. Yet here she was, so to speak, like some brazen hussy, openly making love to another in God's own house. Indeed, in his direct line of vision. What Asherah, I wonder, does God see today when he looks out through the open doors of his churches? I suppose the equivalent in modern terms are things like strip clubs and blue cinemas and pornographic bookshops. Well, they don't have dedicated to Asherah over the door, but the mystery of sex, which she personified, is still idolized in such sordid institutions, even today. What's more, it is publicly condoned in them, just as it was in the case of this idol in Jerusalem. But that wasn't the worst. More to come. Son of man, do you see what they're doing? I'll show you things that will are even more detestable, he says in verse 6. And then he brought me to the entrance to the court, and I looked, I saw a hole, I dug through it. Go in, he said, see what they're doing. So I went in and looked, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals, all the idols of the house of Israel, and in front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel. Built into the temple walls were rooms occupied generally by important people in the national administration. Ezekiel, it seems, is guided through a hidden door into what one might have called an inner sanctum, if sanctity weren't so conspicuous by its absence there. For the walls of this secret chamber had been covered with frescoes, depicting a veritable menagerie of pagan deities, all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals. Of course, the worship of animals is associated in the ancient world often with Egypt. So some commentators have wondered if this clandestine gathering didn't have some political overtones. Were the Jewish leaders plotting alliance with Babylon's great imperial rival? Had they given up on Jehovah and decided to court gods who might be more sympathetic to their ambitions for independence? It's possible. It would certainly explain the need for secrecy. But I'm tempted to think this meeting is not so sinister as that. Do you notice what he says? Each of them worshipping his own idol in verse 12. See what the elders of the house are doing. Each at the shrine of his own idol. They say the Lord doesn't see us. This was no political conspiracy, I think. It was rather a private club where prominent men might indulge their personal idolatrous inclinations without risking their public reputations. You find just the same sort of thing today. Sophisticated, well-educated, well-dressed, respectable men, obsessed like schoolboys with their secret societies, their Masonic lodges, their vice clubs, their black magic covens, and goodness knows what else, all enjoying the esoteric thrill of forbidden fruit within their exclusive fraternities. And still reassuring themselves in the same way these elders of Israel did. Nobody will see us here. Not even God. But there was worse. Verse 13 and 14. He brought me to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord, and I saw women sitting there mourning for Tammuz. Usually, you know, it's the women folk who are the last to lose touch with real religion in any society. I don't know really why that is. Perhaps it's because they trust intuitive feelings more than men do, and so are less reliant on observable evidences of God's presence. Perhaps it's to do with the maternal instinct, a concern for the moral welfare of children. I don't know why it is, but it's certainly so. When mothers stop praying, a society is really in trouble. But that's what was happening here, it seems. Tammuz was a Babylonian god, a handsome youth who, according to legend, died and tragically and some believed might rise again. He provided the focus for a cult of sentimentality that seems to have been particularly attractive to women. As a result, tears that should have been shed for the sins of their husbands and their children were squandered instead on this mythical Adonis. Today, of course, those tears are more likely to be evoked by a Mills Boone romance or a TV soap opera. I'm not sure there's any essential difference. Tammuz was really just a fantasy that provided these women with some avenue of emotional release in their tense and difficult situation. And in that respect, it had much in common with the kind of escapist entertainment that performs the same function in our society today. Millions in this country last night participated in the mythical world of Dallas, waving their fists at JR, sobbing for poor Bobby, who was going to get it yet again. Isn't that the 20th century equivalent of weeping for Tammuz? I think it is. But there's more to come still. Look at verse 15 and 16. He brought me to the inner court of the house of the Lord, and there at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs towards the temple of the Lord, and their faces towards the east, and they were bowing down in the sun, to the sun in the east. You know, step by step, God has been bringing Ezekiel closer and closer to the central sanctuary in this chapter. First the idol in the outer court, then the secret vault in the temple wall, then the women by the gate, And now his attention is drawn to a group of men who stand on the very threshold of the temple buildings themselves. The implication is quite clearly that these were clergy, because this is the spot between the altar and the temple porch where traditionally the priests stood to plead with God for the people's pardon. Again, Bible students will find a reference in Joel chapter 2, verse 17 to that. Well, they were standing there all right, the priests. But you see which way they were facing? Towards the east, not towards the temple. They were worshipping the sun. They had quite literally turned their backs on God. And haven't countless church leaders done the same in our generation? Abandoning the exclusive claims of Jesus for so-called dialogue with other faiths? Surrendering the truth of the gospel in order to espouse the cause of rationalism or the so-called scientific view of the Bible? Every year, men who deny the deity of Christ or the authority of the Bible are ordained to the ministry. No more than that. They are promoted to bishops' palaces or to the chairs of theology of our land. Men who have publicly turned their back on the temple are yet retaining offices within the temple. God puts the question to us, he put to Ezekiel. Verse 17, have you seen this? Is it a trivial matter? Is it a trivial matter that sexual promiscuity is publicly condemned? Is it a trivial matter that the nation's leadership indulge in secret vice? Is it a trivial matter that the emotions of the populace are prostituted on escapist fantasies? Is it a trivial matter that church leaders no longer believe the Apostles' Creed? Oh, be assured, if it seems trivial to us, it does not seem trivial to God. To him, it is an unendurable provocation. They continually provoke me to anger, he says in verse 17. These are detestable practices, he says it again and again and again. They offend him deeply. It seems most likely to me that this strange verse, verse 17, is trying to say that. This business about putting the branch to their nose. Some suggest that's some kind of mysterious pagan rite, and it may be. We may discover more about it one of these days in some archaeological dig. But many commentators, and I'm inclined to think they're right, interpret the Hebrew rather as meaning they are a stench in God's nose. They're turning either their nose up at God, or God's finding them such an offense, such an obscenity to his nostrils, that he turns his nose up at them. See, the glory of God dwelt in this temple. Yet all around it, and even within it, lay the evidence of the nation's unfaithfulness. And God was repelled by such behavior. Is it any wonder that the offended glory felt like leaving home? See what he says in verse 6? Do you see what they're doing here, the utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here? Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. You ask why churches die? This is why churches die. The glory of God is a sensitive guest. He does not stay where he's not wanted. That brings us to our second heading. The glory of God avenged. In chapter 9. Look at the first two verses. Then I heard him call out in a loud voice, "Bring the guards of the city here, each with a weapon in his hand." And I saw six men coming from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen. As obvious, these were not human soldiers. These are the seven angels of God, whose normal function was to defend God's people. But here they're being taken from the city walls, where they were stationed to protect the city of Jerusalem, and given new orders, no longer to protect the city, but rather to execute judgment within it. They do this, we're told, in these chapters in two ways. First, in chapter 9, by the slaughter of the idolaters. And secondly, in chapter 10, by the destruction of the city itself with holy fire. And we thought a lot about judgment last week, so we won't go into some of those details again. But I want you to notice four things about this passage that are slightly new. The first thing I want you to notice is the special protection afforded to the godly within the city. You see that at the end of verse 3 and 4. God, the Lord called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing kit at his side and said to him, "Go throughout the city of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in it." The imagery of Ezekiel often has links with Revelation, and this is a, A classic case, isn't it? Reminding us of the way in the book of Revelation chapter 7, how the angels of wrath are not allowed to act until the servants of God were sealed in their foreheads. I want you to notice the criterion God instructs them to use in distinguishing those who can receive this mark of mercy. Those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in Jerusalem. For you see, we can't always stop the slide towards apostasy in our society. And God doesn't necessarily demand that we should. In a totalitarian regime, it may well be that the power of government censorship and the use of police intimidation silences all protest. Even in our democratic system, though freedom of speech may be guaranteed, there's no way a few Christians can resist the power of the pagan majority indefinitely. What does God expect of his people, then, in days of national moral and spiritual degeneracy? What does he expect? Well, he expects three things. He expects, first of all, dissent, an emphatic mental repudiation of the values and practices of the world. Do not be conformed to the world, says Paul. Be transformed. He expects, secondly, disgust, a deeply felt sense of horror at what is going on, of moral outrage. We read of Abraham's nephew Lot, that though he lived in Sodom, he was day after day tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. But thirdly, what God is emphasizing in these verses, he expects distress, a grieving and lamenting. For God is not impressed by the pious Pharisees who think they can isolate themselves from judgment by living in the smug cocoon of their self-righteousness, the prim virgins in a brothel. No, what God seeks are people who express their dissent and their disgust, not by sanctimonious prudery, but by agonizing sorrow of heart, consciously recognizing that there's a solidarity in sin, that man is a social creature. He can't sever himself from the guilt he sees in his neighbours. Rather, he must be ashamed and disgraced with them, grieving and lamenting. Here, I think, is a solemn warning. We shall be judged, you see, not just on the basis of whether we have personally participated in sin, but on how we have responded to sin in our social environment. Times we don't think enough about that. The second thing I want you to notice is the emotional burden which this premonition of judgment places upon the preacher in verses 7 and 8. They went out and began killing throughout the city, these six angelic soldiers. And while they were killing, I was left alone and I fell face down, crying out, "Our sovereign Lord, are you going to destroy the entire remnant of Israel in this outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem?" The way Ezekiel dwells on the theme of judgment, describing it often with such blood-curdling imagery, we might be led to think that he actually gains some kind of sadistic delight in the subject. But it's clear from here, isn't it, that that is not so. It's true that on occasions Ezekiel is given such an empathy with the mind of God that he does share God's sense of holy satisfaction at the punishment of the wicked, as we saw last week, applauding and cheering as the execution of divine justice upon the idolatrous mountain shrines in chapter 6. But alongside that, we have to set the witness of these verses in chapter 9, where the prophet, appalled at the merciless slaughter which he sees, expresses his real sense of identification, this time with the people under judgment. Every minister of God's word must suffer that tension, identifying on the one hand with God whose word he brings, and on the other hand with the people to whom he brings it. He can't preach judgment, therefore, without praying for mercy. He can't speak to men about God without also speaking to God about men. That's the distinctive agony of his position. And if we don't feel that burden of intercession upon our hearts, then surely it must be because, unlike Ezekiel, we haven't been left alone while the killing is going on outside in the streets. Some commentators complain about the crude and bloody imagery of these warrior angels with drawn swords. But don't you see? Ezekiel uses it because only by visualizing such a barbaric and a gory massacre can the reality of judgment be really brought home to such unimaginative clods as we are with sufficient emotional force. That's the reason for apocalyptic imagery. Because Ezekiel had seen something horrible, and only by using horrible pictures can he possibly get across what he had seen to us. Some of us perhaps were served in the wars, saw people die. All of us, I guess, these days have watched grim scenes of violent death on newsreels and films. Well, take whatever memories you have of such brutality and multiply it by 1,000, and we may be getting somewhere near feeling what we ought to feel about the nightmare of hell and the prospect of men going there. The plight of the lost ought to burden us, disturb us deeply. It ought to drive us to our knees, as it does Ezekiel here. And if it doesn't, then surely we haven't yet learned what an awful thing lostness is. The third lesson I want you to notice from this passage in 9 and 10 is the place where judgment commences. In verse 6, begin at my sanctuary. Begin at my sanctuary. That's where the slaughter began. When God judges the world, he will not begin with the Muslims and the animists and the Buddhists and the Hindus. He will begin with the visible church, with the privileged ones. Don't be surprised if churches are dying. That is the first sign of a society under judgment. It is the first sign that the glory is departing. And that brings us to the third section we've got to look at. The glory is relocated for chapter 11, the passage we read again. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the gate, and there at the entrance of the gate were these 25 men. These are the men who are plotting evil and giving wicked advice in the city. They say, will it not soon be time to build houses? This city is a cooking pot, and we're the meat. It's difficult to know exactly what the evil plotting these men were engaged in was, because it depends on the interpretation of this rather cryptic phrase about the cooking pot. Some people feel they were a political pressure group advocating rebellion against Babylon. Members perhaps of the secret 70 who, remember, conspired within the temple wall. If that's so, then what they're saying perhaps is, Jerusalem is a secure city, it's never been conquered. Just like meat in a cauldron, we're safe from the flames of Babylonian conquest. We're inside a cast iron defense. So now's the time to make a bid for the restoration of our national prosperity. Another ingenious suggestion interpreting this verse is that these words derive from the prophecy of Jeremiah. Although he's never mentioned, of course, in the book of Ezekiel, we know that Jeremiah was an older contemporary of Ezekiel, ministering in Jerusalem whilst Ezekiel was ministering in Babylonia. And in this period of time, between the first and second exiles, we know from Jeremiah chapter 29 that Jeremiah sent a letter to the exiles, was conveyed across the desert to them. And one of the things it said to them was, build houses, settle down in Babylon. And some commentators think, therefore, that this group of leaders in Jerusalem are contradicting that letter. This is not a time to build houses, they're saying. In other words, we're not going to go into exile. We're going to overthrow Babylonia. We're going to be safe here. Well, there may well be an element of truth in those interpretations, but the difficulty I have with it is making sense of verse 6. You have killed many people in this city and filled its streets with the dead. Now, that doesn't sound like the action of a political activist. That sounds like the action of a group of criminals. And I suspect, though they may well have had political overtones to them, these 25 are really a gang of unscrupulous opportunists. who thought that they would take advantage of the lawless state in which Babylon had left Jerusalem, having stripped her of the cream of her manpower and of her aristocracy and of her natural leadership, take advantage of that situation and grab something for themselves. And on that interpretation, what they're saying here is, listen, those exiles, they are the bones and the giblets. Fate has thrown them on the scrap heap. We're the trimmed meat, and we're going to get fat building houses in this juicy soup of Jerusalem out of the wealth they've left behind. If that's so, you see, then the question which is under consideration in this passage is not the advisability of rebelling against Babylon, but of which group of Jews God is going to prosper. The exiles or the residual population in Jerusalem? Which of those two groups of Jews was God going to bless? These 25 tough guys said, he's going to bless us in Jerusalem. But Ezekiel's message is precisely the contrary. Look at verse 11. This city will not be a pot for you, nor will you be the meat in it. I will execute judgment on you. And that verdict, we're told, was immediately confirmed in verse 13 by one of these brigands in the gang being struck dead on the spot. The equivalent, I suppose, in the punctuation of visions, of 5 exclamation marks in normal writing. Now, not only does that interpretation make sense of these implied criminal actions in verse 6, it also makes sense, it seems to me, of what Ezekiel goes on to say in verses 14 and 15. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, your brothers who are your blood relatives and the whole house of Israel are those of whom the people of Jerusalem have said, they are far away from the Lord. This land was given to us as our possession. See, this gang who were trying to grab power in Jerusalem took the line that God had deserted the exiles and that the blessings of Jerusalem belonged to them now. But God is saying to Ezekiel in this passage, no, that isn't so. It is the exiles to whom you must look for the future of the house of Israel. Not your family, not your kindred back in Jerusalem. Nobody there can help you now, Ezekiel. It is the exiles who must be reckoned as your closest kin now, for it's they whom I've determined to bless. Not that lawless and corrupt gang of idolaters who think to line their pockets out of the misfortune of their compatriots. And indeed, that lesson, that the prosperity that God intends to bring in future lies with the exiles and not with the community in Jerusalem, is the same lesson that underlies the strange movements of the Shekinah glory, which Ezekiel reports, not just in chapter 11, but throughout chapters 9, 10, and 11. Just notice this. It was an important element in the reading, though it's spread out rather. If you look back at chapter 9, verse 3, you see there, the glory of God went up from above the cherubim where it had been and moved to the threshold of the temple. In other words, it left the carved ark in the Holy of Holies and moves to the doorway of the temple building. Then in chapter 10, verse 1, we find that strange wheeled platform which Ezekiel had seen in his initial vision, that mobile throne, you remember, with the wheels. That reappears. Then in chapter 10, verse 18, we read that the glory standing by the temple threshold is re-enthroned above those living cherubim on that mobile throne. And then in chapter 10, 19, we read, while I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground, and as they went, the wheels went with them. They stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. The meaning is clear, you see. Step by step, God is leaving, deserting the temple. Just as he threatened he would. He goes to the door of the sanctuary, summons his heavenly chariot, mounts it, and now is about to depart. The question is, of course, where is he going? Where is he setting off for? Where is the glory of the Lord going to rest? Well, you don't have to be a very acute person to discern the implied answer. You see which gate he leaves by. The east gate. In chapter 10, verse 19. Now, what lay to the east of Jerusalem? Why, Babylon, of course. God was going to the exiles. As indeed Ezekiel already knew, because remember, Heavenly throne with the glory of God above it, he had already seen, as he repeatedly says, by the Kebar River, that is in Babylonia, where the exiles were encamped. So if we remain in any doubt that this is the thrust of the passage, I think verse 16 clears it up in chapter 11. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Although I sent them far away among the nations and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they've gone. So you see, Jerusalem was no longer the spiritual center of the people of God. Ezekiel is saying the glory of God has deserted Jerusalem and has been relocated in foreign soil with his people in Babylon. And what's the application of that? What must have been a rather astonishing message for these Jews, who had always thought the glory of God somehow tied to the sacred mountain. Well, I think the application may be several things. First of all, I think it means this, that if and when churches die as a result of God's judgment upon their spiritual declension, it may very well be wise to cast your eyes around to see what new thing God is doing outside the structures of the visible church. It's good to have an idealism about the visible church. And yet if we face realities, we have to admit that the vast majority of revivals were not church-based. Look outside the church in days of spiritual declension. God is often more real outside the visible church in such days than he is within it. The second thing I think that we ought to learn from this is that God is more concerned about the spiritual caliber of his people than the visible evidence of their prosperity in the eyes of the world. And he is not above sacrificing the latter prosperity for the sake of the former spirituality. See what he says in verse 17 and 18 of chapter 11? This is what the sovereign Lord says, I will gather you from the nations and bring you back from the countries where you've been scattered. I will give you back the land of Israel again. They will return to it and remove all its vile images and detestable idols. See, if churches die, it is in the long-term good of the church. We ought not to be too sentimental about the closure of churches. For it may be they will be rebuilt in days to come by a people more spiritually motivated than those who presided over their decline. And the third lesson I think we ought to learn from this strange desertion of the glory from the temple in Jerusalem is that the greatest need of God's people is not church buildings, not the visible means of grace. The greatest needs of God's people is spiritual renewal. See that in verses 19 to 20? I will give them an undivided heart and put a new spirit in them. I will remove from them their heart of stone and give them a heart of flesh. Then they will follow my decrees and be careful to keep my law. They will be my people. I will be their God. Here's a prophecy, you see, that looks not just to the return of the Jews from exile as a chastened and purified people, a prophecy that looks to the coming of that one who would baptize with the Holy Spirit and with fire. One who would bring not national restoration, but spiritual regeneration. One hesitates to read too much into what might be simply an odd coincidence. But you know, there are two little observations in this passage which it seems to me point in a most tantalizing way to Jesus. The first is back in chapter 9, verse 4. That mark they put on the foreheads of those who were grieving and lamenting over the idolatry. Do you know what that mark was? It was the Hebrew letter Tau. There may be nothing in it, of course. I'm sure Ezekiel wasn't aware of any special significance in it. But in the Hebrew script, the ancient Hebrew script, Tau is a cross. The other thing, which I think is even more provocative, is verse 22 and 23. The final desertion of the glory of the Lord en route for Babylon. The cherubim with the wheels beside them spread their wings, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. And the glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. You know where that hill was, of course. The Mount of Olives. 5 centuries later, the glory of God would leave Jerusalem from that same final terminus once again, but this time not in a chariot of fire, but tabernacled in a body of glorified humanity. And on that occasion, he would be going not in judgment, but in order to pour out even more blessing upon the world. I am with you always, he would say, even to the end of the world. It's to your advantage that I go. If I don't go, the Holy Spirit will not come to you. Yes, churches may die, but those of us who live in the light of the new covenant are not particularly worried about church building. For we are the temple of the Holy Spirit ourselves. Let's pray together.